So, pranam to all of you. Good morning from Sri Gudrum in Buenos Aires, Argentina, where I am staying for a few more weeks before continuing with further journeys. And today I want to share some words about, as the title goes, 4X 2.0, updating or upgrading our approach to the four regulative principles. Somehow this is, I will mention some ideas and some further ones connected to some lecture I shared some, maybe 1 month ago or something, in Maduan, Costa Rica, when we spoke about if sex could be bhakti. And in the context of that, I expressed the need for expanding, making more flexible, unflexible, not diluted, but more broad and more deep at the same time, our notion and our approach to the notion, to the idea of the four regulative principles. And so I will mention a briefly, as a recap, what I mentioned on that day about these four regs. And of course, also there is some plan to organize some further talks concerning this notion of if sex can be bhakti or not. But today I will like to concentrate more of this notion of the four regulative principles and how we conceive of them, how we could ideally broaden our appreciation of them, application of them, which all of that, of course, entails becoming more nuanced practitioners, developing a more gray-like, not black and white perspective of Krishna consciousness and the bhakti mark. We are, as Gaudiya Vaishnavas, we are very blessed and fortunate and challenged. Every blessing of fortune brings some challenge that we may become aware of in time. So Gaudiya Vaishnavism is not exception to that rule. And by being members of such a lineage, we are, especially if we want, even more especially by being connected with the Bhaktivinoda Parivar and all that it entails, we belong to a school of thought where no monochromatic perspectives are to be fully embraced on this nor any element in our tradition. As we grow and progress in our sojourn, we will feel and perceive and feel the necessity to understand every single aspect of our tradition in a more broad and more deep way. Whether it pertains to the category of absolute stuff, if you will, or relative stuff, because the two things are also interwoven there. The relative consideration, the absolute consideration, but whatever may be the case, any of those two, still we are invited to transcend monochromatic, if you will, simplistic reductionist view. Because, for example, if one element that we are approaching of Krishna consciousness belongs to the absolute category, let's say, then if that's actually absolute, that's actually infinite. And if something is infinite, we cannot apply, again, simplistic, reductionistic views on it. That this can only be this, this can only be this. We are dealing with infinite tattva, if you will, with a particular unique category that has no beginning, no end. So on that level, on the absolute category, we cannot apply monochromatic view. And on the relative stuff, if the topic is relative, if the topic is not absolute, in that case, we can neither apply a monochromatic view. Because by its very relativity, that situation or that topic will be in need of further adjustment, constant recalibration, if you will, according to time, place, or circumstance. So my point is, whether the delay, the category we are analyzing, the department we are trying to understand is belongs to the absolute consideration or to the relative one, in neither of those cases, we are to approach it with the simplistic, reductionistic, black and white, monochromatic view. So again, Deshakalapatra is an important thing to consider in this connection. Today we will be speaking about the four regulative principles. So what I mentioned in the lecture that I referred to in the beginning about this is that it's important for us to expand how much we are grasping the implications of each one of these four regulations. That generally, sometimes when some devotees are asked about what's that about, to begin with, sometimes devotees are being asked, what are you about? And sometimes they initially reply by invoking these four regulative principles. Like if this is the all in all or the main gist of Krishna Bhakti, which is not. And after quoting, after saying that, they will quote those four in terms of don'ts, in terms of four things that we do not do, which again for me is not the most comprehensive way of expressing what these four principles are about. Principles of freedom, as Srila Prabhupada many times also mentioned. So if we speak about freedom, of course there is the negative side of freedom, or if you want to speak of moksha, mukti, to be free from something, to get rid of, to transcend this or that. But also it has to contain, especially in our particular tradition, which is not jnana, which is not a tradition that is after a merely mukti, but which has a very deep positive content, as Srila Siddhar Maharaj will describe, in progressive and positive immortality. So we are after something which is positive. So that's important, the most important part of the equation for us. So again, sometimes devotees will say, what we are about? These four regulations. What are these four regulations about? These four don'ts. And that gives us like with a sensation, a sense of negativity, basically, of even evasiveness or even of indifference, instead of the all-encompassing principle of bhakti, which can embrace everything and include everything in its own equation, in the love equation, in its proper context and situation. So what I mentioned in the previous class was that instead of expressing or thinking, not even this is not something about to how you present yourself to the public, but actually how you present yourself to yourself, how you yourself conceive of yourself as a devotee, as a practitioner, how you conceive yourself, how you conceive bhakti for yourself. Because according to how you conceive bhakti to yourself, you will be developing a particular conception of you as a bhakta, as a practitioner of bhakti, towards yourself. So if that's only negative terms, that will be very limiting, and in time that may create considerable shortcomings. So mainly I mentioned that instead of saying no intoxication, no meat eating, no gambling, and no illicit sex, whatever that means, instead of starting the sentence with no, of course that's part of the equation, but which are the do's about the don'ts, if you will? Which are the things or the positive virtues that each one of these four principles are trying to promote? But avoiding certain engagements, of course. And of course, as we know, that's there also. The principle of tapas, the principle of socham, the principle of ahimsa, the principle of satya, no? Truthfulness, austerity, cleanliness, and compassion or non-violence, if you want to put it still negative on one level, but ultimately it's compassion and mercy. And of course, it's not only about expressing them to others or to ourselves in positive terms, but also extending its application way beyond a certain specific practice, which kind of may like summarize or represent all that virtue is about. Like we mentioned, you may be vegetarian, you may be vegan, you may be breatharian, pranic. And not necessarily that means that you are fully ahimsa, that you are fully compassionate, or that you are fully nonviolent. That's an aspect of that. By doing that, that will help you, or that may help you, only if you understand the gist of that practice, vegetarianism, if you will, veganism, and how you are to extend that to other realms as well. It's not that I became vegan and I hate whoever is not vegan, or I became pranic and I criticize whoever is not in my party. And the same applies with all the other things, as we will see. I may not consume substances to intoxicate my mind and so on, my body, but I still may fall into other forms of intoxication. Legal ones, even in the context of Krishna Bhakti, if you will. Or things like this. So it's important to see beyond these four specific practices, these four specific don'ts, and understand these don'ts are promoting a do, a positive virtue, and that virtue is not circumscribed to that specific activity of no gambling, for example, like we mentioned. It's not that because you don't visit the nearby casino, you are being totally truthful. I mean, there are so many ways in which we should be truthful, and we may fail in that while still not gambling, officially gambling. But again, what's gambling ultimately? What's all the possible applications of that? So this is, for me at least, I try to visualize, if you will, this notion, approach the notion of the principle from this side. And for me, this is expanding and broadening the spectrum of application, of understanding of these four regulative principles. And by doing so, at least for me, I'm making this its application actually more comprehensive, broader, and deeper. And of course, more difficult as well. Because sometimes someone may think, why you are given novel idea and that's kind of diluting the original version. You're kind of downplaying the traditional understanding. But actually, if you really understand the implications of that, actually, if you make an approach to something more comprehensive and so on, that becomes more challenging, because that's showing you that there are so many other ways in which those same things are to be found and applied and embraced and worked on. And again, continue with the non-black and white understanding of the four regulative principles. Also, many other things can happen. That, for example, someone may be a very strict follower of, let's say, one of these four. Ideally, we are expected to follow all of the four. But some devotees or someone may specialize himself, herself, becoming especially staunch follower, a particular one, or each one of them, but one may be breaking others while following them. For example, let's give some example a little bit in connection with the topic that we spoke in the previous class about if sex could be bhakti. So some people will say, okay, illicit sex means only sex if you have it. I mean, ideally celibacy, but if you have it, that will be only for procreation. So someone may be a strict follower of that principle and may only have sex for procreation, but maybe that person may be failing in the principle of ahimsa, because that person actually may be doing that from a forced place, from a repressed side, and it may be violent with himself by doing that, or maybe violent with his partner or her partner by doing that, if that sense control, if you will, or celibacy is not carried, dealt with sincerely, with integrity and honesty. Or actually by doing that also, I may be failing in the principle of truthfulness, because I'm not being fully transparent with myself. Somehow I'm being hypocrite. I'm not acknowledging certain situation in which we are in, and I'm trying to force, to impose on me or on others, a particular standard which is more close to anukarana than anusharana, and more close to imitation than to follow the essence of something. So again, I'm giving one example of many in which we may, again, follow strictly something and even speak about that in loud voice as to justify ourselves. But in the name of being strict in that, I'm breaking all the other principles by my quote-unquote strictness. So another consideration for us to think in these four regs in a more if you will, liquid way, in a more, not in a fixed, static way, but dynamic. And of course, again, if we engage in an overdose of don'ts, if we overemphasize what not to do, without seeing nor appreciating the reach of the do's, of what can be done, what could be ultimately attained in a positive sense, if we have not trained our vision to concentrate mostly on the positive side, and we overemphasize the don'ts, we may even end up developing gyan samskars, which are unfavorable, practical for bhakti. We may be developing impressions in the direction of rejection. I'm not proper embracing, as I always like to say, transcendence is not about rejecting anything, but integrating everything. It's not about indifference. It's not about rejection. It's not about being evasive, but it's about integration. So, again, too much don'ts for a bhakta, at least, this is mostly directed for bhaktas, may end up in gyan samskars. And our bhakti project may end up being affected, if you will, by gyan, the notion of gyan, covered by gyan, basically. The definition of bhakti, the official definition of bhakti in our particular school given by Sri Rupa Goswami, Uttam Bhakti in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, actually implies the opposite. Anyabhilasita sunyam gyan karma adi anabritam. So the bhakti we want to pursue is unencumbered by gyan, among other things, by karma, by adi, by other things like tapasya, and some other things in which you will think, by doing that, I need to do this so for my bhakti to improve. And you start to give less importance to bhakti and more importance to something else, which will come, which is totally, dependent of bhakti, or secondary to bhakti, depending on the case. So by too much emphasis on the don'ts in the name of following the four regs, we may be end up contradicting the ideal definition of devotion that we have received in our school. And if you increase these gyan samskars, even without being aware of that, that may affect your ultimate destiny. There is a very interesting lecture that Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta gave called Anarthanibriti and Arthaprabriti. Very interesting, very recommended. Where he's mentioning how, okay, yes, we speak about anarthanibriti, getting rid of anarthas, but actually that's not the goal of our practice. That's not the ultimate emphasis. The ultimate goal is arthaprabriti, to enter into the positive service of Sri Sri Radha and Krishna in Braj, he will say. So we only speak about anarthanibriti in the context of arthaprabriti, with that arthaprabriti in mind, with that positive, ultimate converging point in mind. If we lose sight of that positive side of the equation, and we only end up emphasizing anarthanibriti and just cultivating a rejection and negativity, if you will, too much neti-neti, this not, he will say in that conference, Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta, you may end up in Brahman, not in Golok, not with Sri Sri Radha and Krishna, because you have inadvertently, maybe, develop too many gyan samskars and conceive the whole practice, your whole life, in terms of neti-neti, in terms of this not, that not, rejection, instead of what to do, which is the positive engagement here. So I'm just trying to play out some of the ultimate implications of not properly conceive something like the four regulative principles, according to what our Purvacharyas have shared. And of course, this is quite tied to gyan samskars, to vairagya samskars. You know, sometimes one may come with that from before, or may somehow filter bhakti in those terms, thinking that all this is about, again, escaping from the world, or saying no to that and saying no to this, which actually vairagya is not an anga of bhakti. If you analyze the 64 angas of sadhana bhakti gave by Sri Rupa Goswami, vairagya is not there. accepting sannyas is not there, brahmacharya is not there. While those things are actually there in other paths, if you study the yama niyamas of Patanjali, of yoga, brahmacharya is there. If you study the angas of jnana that Shankaracharya is presenting in his particular school, accepting sannyas is a prerequisite for attaining moksha. But if you study bhakti angas, that's not there at all. Why? Because bhakti is so much powerful. It's not that you need to first do all those things in order to attain sannyas. Bhakti by herself, by her own strength and power, can rise us to the highest platform. It's not that you need to be sannyas. You need to be brahmachari. Naham vipru na chana rapati kiva vipra kiva nyasa sudra ke nihai. Grihe tako vane tako bolo. Sadahari boli tako se bhakti no tako. So, renunciation is not a main feature in bhakti. Of course, there is a type of renunciation, but the renunciation is in the context of bhakti, or we could say for the sake of bhakti, for the sake of further bhakti. No? That's what we call pratikulyasya varjanam. The famous verse, anukulyasya sankalpa, pratikulyasya varjanam. That's our renunciation. I will say no to those things that are unfavorable to bhakti. That's one of the six limbs of Sharanagati. To reject, if you want to call it like that, those things which are not favorable for bhakti. And things or those ways of thought that won't promote, won't foster the proper conception of bhakti. So again, that's our vairagya as Gaudiyas. Whether you are Grihastha, Brahmachari, Sannyas, Paramahamsa, Vesh, whatever. That's pratikulyasya varjana. Whatever is not nourishing for my bhakti, that I won't accept. And that may take different forms and may change in time. In certain stages, something won't be favorable. In some other stages, that will. So it's a dynamic, moving criterion. And this pratikulyasya varjana, as I mentioned, is not about rejecting certain things in particular. At least not for everyone. But how to approach those things in particular. It's not about rejecting the situation, the practice, the person, the stuff, but it's about rejecting the unfavorable conception of that person, stuff, situation, and embracing, again, there's always a positive side, anukulya sankalpa, making a firm determination, an oath, even a vow, like I will approach and embrace everything in the highest, most favorable possible way for nourishing my bhakti. That's our commitment with the ideal, basically. Because again, everything in one way has the potential to become a form of bhakti. We already spoke that in this previous lecture about if sex could be bhakti, and what to speak, any other thing. So everything, bhakti is so powerful that everything has the potential to become connected with bhakti and indeed in this way be part of our devotional project. So again, what we are rejecting is actually the misuse or misreading of reality in such a way that it is not allowing us to connect with reality in terms of bhakti. But we are not rejecting the totality of that, because that same thing has a particular way of being approached in the context of bhakti. So we only reject our own potential misreading of reality that is not allowing us to take advantage of the bhakti potential that is waiting for us. So that on another side, of course, recently also comes to my mind one devotee who was asking me, well, there's one guru from one particular group that is not in good shape regarding health, and there they sent some public like request saying like Gurudev is not very healthy, so please all of you disciples of him do not break the four regulative principles because that will affect his health. And of course I won't enter into the details of that. You can watch the Q&A, the specific respective istagosti in that regard. But I was thinking, I don't agree with that. Actually, that has a more karmakanda kind of conception. To begin with, it's not that that the guru is taking the karma of the disciples, because to begin with, ideally a disciple, if we have to speak about disciple, which means surrendered disciple, someone who at least theoretically, voluntarily accepts the notion of Saranagati to begin with, because that's the beginning of bhakti. That's the ground, the foundation for the bhakti project to be built on. If such a disciple is having that proper conception and voluntarily accepting that before accepting Sri Guru, Ado Guru Padashraya, then such a disciple, we cannot speak anymore in terms of karma, technically speaking, according to our acharyas. But because the devotee is entering into bhakti, it's another set of laws, another set of codes in that realm. There's no longer papa, nor punya. There's no longer sin, nor ordinary piety, if you will. If we want to speak of punya, like the Bhagavatam say, krita punya punya, and so on, that has to do with other type of credit, if you will, merit. Bhakti sukrit, if you want to put it. So, if a devotee is sincerely surrendered, bhakti is the prerogative. Or, the other possibility, God forbid, is aparadh. There's no longer papa and punya. No? From that moment on, there is bhakti and aparadh. So, if a devotee, is a sincere practitioner, fell down, if you want to use that term, experienced some shortcoming in his or her path, there's a particular way to act in that connection, but it has nothing to do with karma, what to speak of the guru taking the karma, which ideally should not be there, from the disciple and being affected in hell. But again, so the Bhagavatam is, there are two very nice verses in chapter 11, which also I think will help a lot the devotees, who sometimes some of them may have difficulties with maintaining themselves in these four regulative principles, how to understand the situation in the context of bhakti. Because I've seen lots of neurosis in the name of not being able to sustain themselves in those principles to the point of feeling I cannot be a devotee and so on. So in the 11th canto, chapter 20, verses 27-28, they're very nice, two very well-known verses and very nice one. Jatasradamatkatasu nirvina sarvakarmasu vedadu katma kamkamam parittegepyanishvara tatova jetamam prita sradalur dhritanishtaya jusamanaschuta chatankamam dukodharkam stagarhayam. So we'll see lots of common sense in these verses, which sometimes is not so common. But which should be present the more we advance. No? As we mentioned the other day, an Uttam Adhikari is not only Shastra Nipun, but Yukta Nipun. It's not only scriptural genius, but it's also genius regarding logic. And logic does not mean only here expert in the Nyaya Shastras, but he's expert or she's expert in logic, in being logical, in having common sense, which sometimes is a really missing element, even in the name of quoting Shastra and so on. So the Bhagavatam is giving us very very organic common sense, saying having Krishna himself is saying that having awakened, speaking with Uttuda, having awakened faith in my Hari Katha, Jatasradu Matkata, so in my Katha, having developed Shraddha, Jatasradha, having faith being born in their heart, in connection to my katha, nirvina sarvakarmasu, experiencing nirvina or disgust towards all types of material engagements, veda dukhatmakam kaman, veda knowing dukha atmakam kamam, knowing that sense gratification kam, dukha atmakam, its nature is dukha, is taken to suffering, parityage api anishwara api, but still not being able, parityage, to fully renounce that sense gratification. How my devotee should engage in that sense? Tato bhajeta mam pritha. He should remain happy. And sradalur dridanishtaya. He should worship me firmly, with great conviction, with great faith. Not become discouraged. And yusamanascha dagamam dukkha dargamascha garhayam. Even though sometimes that devotee may be engaged in sense enjoyment, let's say, or he may broke some of the principle, my devotee knows that all this karma, all this selfish exploitation, if you will, it's leading to some miserable result. And dukkha dargamascha garhayam, he or she sincerely repents such activities. So very, again, commonsensical advice. If you are a bhakta and you have failed in whatever, the thing you need to do basically is to return to bhakti. You fail, the ground is the same thing that will help you to rise again and to stand up and to continue embracing the practice with sincere repentance. And bhakti itself will cover all those faults, will purify and eventually help you transcend. No need for an unnecessary guilt and to take a whip and chastise you and just remain in the center and become self-centered in the context of playing the victim or who knows what. So that's the stance of Krishna. He's our Ishtadev. He's quite dynamic, as you know. He says in the Gita, in probably the most controversial verse, He said, even if you engage in sudurachar, achar means behavior, durachar means bad behavior, sudurachar means very bad behavior. So even if you engage in such very bad behavior, but if you are determined on continuing worshipping me, if that person has that focus, that commitment to the path, Krishna said, for me, she is a saint. So, again, that's generally not the classical definition that we hear of the saint or that we give to ourselves when sometimes we idealize something in total perfection and so on. But Krishna is much more realistic and he knows what will happen in most of us in our path. But nonetheless, he appreciates. Baba Grahi Janardana, he takes the very essence of our attitude and from that he develops a very generous outlook on us, which gives us so much hope. Because if you are falling, you are failing, but sincerely you want to continue, for Krishna you are already a saint. Again, this is not to abuse Krishna's generosity, but actually to get filled with hope. It's so humbling, and of course it will empower us so much. So why I'm saying all this in the context of the four regulative principles again, because if you consider this type of notions that are given in Shastra by Bhagavan himself, there's even place, and hopefully you don't feel too much shocked by this, because they are not my words, they are Krishna's, but there's even place to consider a falling down as part of bhakti. Not only sex can be bhakti, but falling down can be bhakti also. Because that falling down is happening in the context of bhakti. You are practicing bhakti sincerely, but for whatever reason, you fell down in some way. Again, of course, if you are sincerely determined to surrender, strictly speaking, you have not fell down, even though externally it seems so. So in connection to that apparent falling, still that's in the context of bhakti. If you're trying to pursue devotion sincerely, so that's actually not a falling in itself, because you are falling in such a way that you are sincerely practicing. So we could say you are sincerely falling. And because of your sincerity, that falling will create a teachable moment, proper repentance and humility, which will upgrade you to a much better situation in the near future. So how much we can speak about falling? In the language of Richard Rohr, falling upward. He has a book with that name, very nice one. And so he speaks about the importance of going down if you want to go up. The need for touching the floor. That's what ideally, we put our heads to the ground many times per day. You go down first and then you can go up. So in that sense, there's place for considering falling down as part of bhakti. a breaking of the regulative principles, again, unintentionally, as part of bhakti. Because this implies you will learn from that experience. You will feel a certain healthy repentance that will promote further bhakti. If you still cannot accommodate that or cannot believe me, I mean, again, this is not my idea. This is what Krishna says in the Gita and the Bhagavad. Let's take Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur's description of Anishtita Bhajana Kriya in his Madhurya Kadambini, famous, very beautiful book in which he depicts the different stages, gives us the map from Shraddha to Prem and all in between stages. And when he speaks about Anishtita or unstable, without Nishta, practice of bhakti, he divides that in six symptoms. And one of them, not only one, but we could call one, you can mention many of them, besides Sangara, Sagara, you're struggling with the senses and so on, but he mentions Niyama Akshama. So Niyama Akshama means basically lack of capacity to maintain your vows. So it's another way of putting breaking the regulative principles. And he's mentioning that stage is one of the six symptoms of Anishtita Bhajana Kriya or Anishtita Bhakti. But that's still bhakti. Do you understand? And that's still glorious in itself. If you are, again, not abusing this, not using this as an excuse, but going through the motions of your particular stage and learning by that. So Anishtita Bhajana Kriya means unstable practice of bhakti. And that may be embarrassing when you read all the six symptoms and you are tempted to raise your hand in the six of them. Yes, that's me, that's me. But you shouldn't feel discouraged. You should feel, but that's still in the context of bhakti. So in other words, Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur generously says, I know you will have to go through most of these. Most of you will have to most of these stages. But that's in the context of a glorious journey. Journey home. So there's nothing to feel ultimately embarrassed about, but to feel fortunate about, graced by. So again, there's place to understand, I don't have the capacity to sustain my bhav, niyama akshama. That's in the context of bhakti, if sincerely experience. What else we can say regarding the four regulative principles and trying to provide some nuanced approaches to that? Sometimes there's like a saying that you may engage in sins of commission and sins of omission. That's an interesting notion to apply in this connection. Okay, of course I mentioned that surrender both is beyond the ordinary sense of sin and piety, but I'm using the wording, the popular wording of these concepts. I hope you understand. So what's the meaning of sins of commission and sins of omission? For example, people generally, and devotees may not be an exception to this, they generally believe that to actively doing something bad is a sin of commission. You are committing, you are breaking the four regs. And people generally, interestingly, believe that on average, at least, they are worse than sins of omission, which means to passively not doing something good. That's a sin of omission. You could do something good, but you are not doing it. The other one is, you could do something bad and you're doing it. So sometimes our notion of mistake or sin or whatever you want to call it, word it, is most in the connection of you did something wrong. But sometimes we do not put on the other side of the scale how that same thing plays out in the other way. You could have done something good, but you have not done it. And you may know even what you have to do, what good things you can do, you should do. You may know it, and you are still not doing that. So the latter, the sense of omission, which is another, we may call that also willful blindness, because you do not want to look into that direction, although you know in your consciousness that's present. This sense of omission occurs when, again, you could come to know something, you could go deeper into some direction that intuitively you feel I have to, but you cease exploring. in that direction. And because of that, you fail to discover something, whatever it may be, that might cost you growth, but before growth might cost you substantial discomfort, because it's taking you out of your comfort zone. It's taking you into the unknown, where you will become aware of things that you may not like to hear. And this sense of omission can be worse than the sense of commission. Because again, they may perpetrate an attitude of hypocrisy, evasiveness. I don't want to look into that direction. I don't want to hear that. I don't want to become aware of the things I have to do. I can do. I should do, and I'm not doing. So to follow that, and maybe someone else may engage in a sin of commission, may break one regulative principle, but may humbly repent and grow through that, as we mentioned, quoting these verses from the Bhagavatam. You follow. So sometimes we may be shocked, oh, that devotee broke one of the four regulative principles, all the four. But what's going on after that, in the heart of that person, there may be a total transformative experience that is taking that person to be much upgraded. And on the other side, we have someone who's not breaking those principles, but who should engage in some positive things that he's not doing, and developing an evasive mentality, and criticizing those who engage in sins of commission, while he or she is engaging in sins of omission. So again, the four regulative principles may seem that they have more to do with sins of commission. You should not do this, you should not do that. But try to make that broader and try to include the sins of omission in that, because all that put together makes for a complete, comprehensive stance with integrity in the path of bhakti. Also, these four regulative principles, in one sense, are not necessarily absolute, but are relative. And what do I imply with this? Of course, if something is relative, as I mentioned before, that takes us to consider time, place, circumstance, desha, kala, patra, like the Bhagavatam mentions also, desha, kala, vibhagavat. You should become a knower of what to do according to the particular time, place, and circumstance. So in which context I'm saying that? Of course, the virtues that are promoted through these four regulative principles are always to be pursued. But how we pursue them and how we avoid embracing the misinterpretation or the distorted side of them, that may take so many different forms according to time, place, or circumstance. How to develop, again, compassion, how to be truthful, how to, again, be clean and austere, that's not a fixed thing. That it will be only in one way for all times and places, for every single person in every situation. And especially nowadays, I will say that apart from these four regulative principles, we should, if you will, at least for ourselves, add to that a fifth one, which has to do with how we deal with social media, for example. Because we are in that particular age, we are in the digital age, we are in the age of social interaction through technology, which happens a lot in private. No, each of us has our own private world in our pocket, if you will. So who else is seeing that? Of course, Krishna in our heart. But my point is, we can cheat ourselves so much in that context, and we can break all the principles there. So I would say that it's important for every one of us, for every member of the parampara, to keep updating. That's why I'm humbly trying to serve our lineage and all its members by sharing some of these words. It's the duty of each one of us as a member, contributing member of the parampara, or at least for those who act as public intellectuals in the parampara, as brahmanas, as thinkers, if you will, to catch like the zeitgeist or the climate of the times, and to update generationally their approach, their conception of these types of concepts which are quite malleable. Again, which form they will take in a particular time, it may be very different than what happened 50 years ago when Srila Prabhupada came to the West, if you will, and established more officially this four regulative principle for his disciples. In 50 years, the world has changed so much, especially with the speed of the present times. 50 years, in 50 years, there will be more change than the changes that you had in 1,000 years, 3,000 years ago. So regarding this extra, if you will, consideration related to social media, again, a big part of this update that we as active members of the Sampradaya should have in mind has to do with our life in social media, with our identity in social media, with how do we see ourselves through social media, and maybe, as I mentioned, with how we may be breaking all the four regulative principles in social media. I remember one comic that one good brother of mine, Guru Nishtha Prabhu, he uses to post very, very nice ones, comics, Half the Way Home. That's the title of the series. And he mentioned there that there was one frame comic, and there what you found there was like Guru giving initiation to the disciple, and it's clear that the Guru was mentioning the four regulative principles and said, and no Facebook. And the face of the disciple is like going totally nuts, like, stop here, I can still deny my initiation here. Which, of course, I'm not saying with this that the Guru should say that to the disciple, but the point, of course, the gist of the thing is that it may be even easier for us to say yes to the four regulative principles, but if we receive a fifth one concerning how to follow those four in social media, that may make things much more complicated. And again, we may be strictly following the four regulative principles outside of social media, but we may be breaking the four of them inside it. And of course, it can take so many different forms. So let me just share some immediate notions. Now you may say, okay, I'm Maharaj, how you can have illicit sex in social media? Of course, what to speak of watching pornography, things like this. You can even be masturbating your ego through social media. That's a form of illicit sex, technically speaking. Or you can be intoxicating your ego, your false sense of self. You're fooling yourself out of being trained to fool, to make yourself fool with you by presenting whatever. Now, you may be intoxicating yourself with gramya katha. You may be intoxicating yourself with envy by watching other posts or trying to present yourself what you are not, or I don't know, you may become addicted to video games. I heard about this, like strictly emphasizing following the four regs by acknowledging I'm addicted to video games. So how much that is not a type of gambling, for example, to engage in video game or substance abuse. You fall. So, or truthfulness, no? In social media, many people is not fully truthful because they are trying to sell, if you will, to show a picture of themselves to the world that is not coinciding with reality. It's not matching the inner world of that person. With this, I'm not saying you have to reveal your mind openly to all your Facebook contacts, but also be careful with not, again, trying to cheat yourself by selling an idealistic projection that is not happening. So that may be, again, breaking the four regulative principles in terms of intoxication, again, untruthfulness, uncleanliness, and so on. And so many other layers of consideration will come, especially in the near future. For example, now recently we have heard about this metaverse, this 3D reality, which you will have your own avatar, and you may have your parallel sense of existence in which you can do so many things you may not be able to do on the physical realm. So again, we have to think how to recalibrate our conception of the four regs in the metaverse, as they call it. Because, for example, I don't know, some things come to mind. in Shastra they said, if you commit an offense, aparad, with your body, let's say you physically attacked a Vaishnava, you have to counteract that on physical terms. If you think offensively of a Vaishnava, you can counteract that mentally. And if you speak, you engage in aparad through your mouth, you should counteract that on that platform. So, but to which category, in which category of these three, for example, should metaverse enter? You can have your own avatar in the metaverse, and there you are doing any nonsense or whatever, and you're breaking the principles of how, in which category, in which department this belongs. So again, we should think how this original notion of four regulative principles, how that extends and applies and takes different shapes according to each time, place, or series, and how I remain updated into how applying myself to my into practice, so I can be properly promoting the virtues that those regulations are trying to give me. And again, I don't want to. You are more aware than me about what's going on when we connect to social media from an improper source. No, I mean social media is intimately connected with dopamine, as you know, and dopamine is creating a very similar effect to other addictive substances that we may take in the context of intoxication. No? I mean, dopamine essentially produces the pleasure that is related with hope or possibility, or anticipation, if you want to put it. So it creates that sense of anticipation, that adrenaline, if you will, dopamine, we call it. But it's a very subtle pleasure. That is, of course, the thing that drags us over and over again to see, are there any more likes or any comments or anything the world is saying about me? But the underlying principle of that is basically the same as when you are taking another substance to create that same type of experience. So again, how much that is not breaking one of the regulative principles and how we are to interact with that. So some thoughts regarding these four principles. Of course, going back to bhakti, just trying to conclude my presentation, is on top of this, we have these principles, sometimes I'll call the dharma, principles of dharma, or the principles of religion, as you know, they appear as such in the Bhagavatam, with the bull being the personification of dharma. As we know the whole story, three legs are gone, only one leg remains, Parikshimaras is there, personification of Kali's wanting to destroy the last one, truthfulness, and so on. So if these four regulative principles are connected to dharma, and if you want to see the concept of dharma in the context of the four purusharthas or goals of human life, first one of which is dharma, artha, kama, moksha. Technically speaking, if you want to take that approach, for us Gaudiyas, these four purusharthas, including dharma, including these four principles that are part of dharma, we call them kaitav dharma. Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami gives that very strong statement, almost revolutionary, when he's explaining one, the Namaskar Shloka from the Mangala Charan of Chaitanya Charitamrita. Vande Sri Krishna Chaitanya Nityananda Saharita Godadai Pushpavantu Chitra Sangdo Tamonudo. And he said, Tamonudo, these two brothers, Gaur Nityananda, they rise on the horizon of Goda like the sun of the moon simultaneously, and to bestow all auspiciousness and to dissipate the darkness of ignorance. And he said, and he, when he explains that darkness, tamonudo, dissipating the darkness, what's this darkness? He says, kaitav dharma, cheating religion. And to be more specific, what do I mean by that? He says, dharma, artha, kama, moksha, the so-called goals of life for most of the people. Because why? What this Gaur Nityananda came to give is a fifth goal, pancham purusartha or prem, in comparison to which is all the other goals are reduced to the category of cheating. And the Bhagavatam mostly starts with that. Dharma prajita kaita vatra paramonir matsana namsatam. Again, in the Mangalacharan, Vastu Nirdesh Shloka of the Bhagavatam, this book is not, is totally prajita, is totally rejecting dharma prajita kaitava, the same idea. Totally rejection of kaitava dharma is found in this book. So the very first almost verse of the book is presenting its stance. What the book is about, Vastu Nirdesh. So and we are Gaudiyas, we are embracing that ideally. So our only emphasis, so my point is, be very careful that when you emphasize the four regulative principles, you are doing that in the proper context, understanding their role in the service of bhakti and not just taking it as a separate thing that you overemphasize for the sake of who knows what, a sense of purity or what, separate from bhakti. So our particular emphasis as Gaudiyas in connection to these four regulative principles is in the context of creating some balanced humanity in us, if you will. Creating some sense of sattva, basically. Sattva gun, from which we can more easily grab transcendence, if you will. We can more easily grasp what's even above, beyond sattva. Because even sattva contains some rajas and tamas. All the three gunas are always intermixed with each other. So sattva is not a destiny unto itself. Sattva is an airport. It's like if you go to the airport is not the ultimate destiny. You go to the airport to take a plane to reach your ultimate destiny. So sattva guna, which has to do a lot with taming the beast in us, has more to do with arriving to the airport, you know, with facilitating penetration into transcendence, basically. So, and these four principles, again, these four regulations have more to do with that, to civilizing ourselves. But if you become overtly concerned about just following them, somehow you become over-attached to these principles, means you can become over-attached to sattva, and over-attachment to sattva or to whatever, of course not transcendentally speaking, over-attachment to sattva in itself is no longer sattva. Excessive attachment to sattva is rajas. So your so-called sattva became degraded to the category of rajas. And of course, you are in rajas, it's more difficult to sustain certain things and so on. So these four regulations are in the service of bhakti. Sattva is in the service of visuddha sattva. And also, if you want to speak about these four regs in another context, they find their ultimate face, if you will, their ultimate expression in bhakti. In other words, bhakti is a fifth goal, or prem, if you will, is a fifth goal above these four. But in that fifth goal, you find included these previous four purusharthas in their most ultimate perfect expression. So how this plays itself out, if you want to speak about dharma, artha, kama, and moksha. Okay, when you speak about dharma, in prem you find that. You find prem and dharma, the ultimate notion of dharma. Dharma means dharma, that which dhara sustains ma, me. So ultimately, we are sustained by prem. That's the real basis for us. The Bhagavatam itself speaks about paradharma. Sabhaipam samparodharma jato bhakti radakshaye. Haitukya pratihata jayatma suprasidhati. So Bhagavatam rejects kaitab dharma, but speaks about paradharma or prem dharma with supreme duty or the supreme function. Jaiva dharma, as Sri Thakur Bhaktivinoda will express, the ultimate potential of the jiva in connection to its source and in connection to bhakti. So we find dharma in bhakti. Artha, of course, we also find, artha can be translated not only as wealth, but as necessity, as purpose. So full our ultimate necessity is prem, our ultimate purpose is found in prem, which is the ultimate expression of bhakti. So artha appears as bhakti in the form of panchama purushartha. We have the purushartas and panchama purusha artha. Artha again means benefit, wealth, golokera premadhan, harinam sankirtan. The wealth of golok is coming to us by harinam sankirtan. So dharma, artha, kama, well, you have kama rupa bhakti. Ultimately, the perfection of kama is found in the braj, the figure embodied in the braj gopikas. Kama rupa bhakti and the bhakti who follows in its wake Kamanuga Bhakti. So calm is found in bhakti in its ultimate form. And moksha, also moksha. For us, Gaudiya's moksha ultimately, or mukti, is synonym with bhakti. In the 12th canto, Srimad Bhagavatam mentions that Kaivalyam Eka Prajoyanam, interestingly, which you should know how to read it. Srila Jiva Goswami gives a very good, nice explanation of it in his Priti Sandarbha, mentioning how Kaivalya, which is generally a term used by the followers of Advaita Vedanta to imply onlyness, Kaivalya comes from Keval, Keval means only, and Kaivalya means onlyness, which has to do with this idea of being, everything is Brahman. But actually, Kaivalyam ek prayojanam, says the Bhagavatam. The prayojan of this treatise is Kaivalya. So at this point, Advaita Bhadis are celebrating. But of course, Jiva Goswami explained that in the context of everything else the Bhagavatam is mentioning, and showing how this Kaivalya has to do with unity, becoming one, but a dynamic unity, as my Guru Maharaj likes to say, you and I become we. In love, that's the reality. Like Alankar Kavstu, Kavi Karnapur says that, you know, Radha and Krishna are speaking to each other and say, those who say, I love you, do not know nothing about love, because still the I and the you remains, the separate sense of identity remains, while in love, there's a very substantive sense of union. So we have this actual Kaivalya, or moksha, ultimately in the form of unity, in the form of prem. So again, excessive emphasis on the four regulative principles without understanding all this, without understanding what's bhakti, I will say, that also can make our bhakti karma covered or encumbered by karma. As we already mentioned before, be careful of not making your bhakti diluted by jnana. That can also happen by overemphasizing sattva, by overemphasizing these four regulative principles, and your bhakti may be covered by karma, by not understanding the role of these principles in the context, in the service of bhakti. So, just to finish, well, generally, again, at least in some particular schools, missions, especially the one founded by Srila Prabhupada, these four regulative principles are requested from the disciples, not necessarily in every single Gaudiya school, which, of course, I'm not criticizing one or the other, there are different standards, but the gist of it all is the same. Also, one of the principles or commitments requested to the student is the chanting of Srinam, a particular commitment of chanting a certain number of rounds. And in that connection, I will like to finish by invoking another set of four regulative principles that are quite connected with the chanting, quite connected with bhakti, and that we found in probably the most important thing that Mahaprabhu has ever said, which is Shikshastakam, third verse, Trinada Pishunichena, Taruari Basa Hishnuna, Amani Namanadina Kirtaniya Sadari. So there we find, I will say, the four regulative principles of bhakti. Of course, the other four regulative principles can be bhakti if they are properly associated with bhakti, but someone can also follow them outside of the context of bhakti. But in this third verse of Shikshastakam, Mahaprabhu is speaking about four regulative principles clearly in the context of bhakti. The four regulative, these four pillars, which are Sunichena, Sahishnuna, Amanina, Manadena. And all of them four played out in the context of Kirtaniya Sadahari, of constant engagement of Sri Hari Kirtan. Of course, we have no time now to analyze these four pillars and all that this third verse entails, but of course, you know, it speaks about a particular type of humility, like that of the grass, a particular type of tolerance, like that of the tree, and a particular type of giving respect and not expecting respect for oneself. Again, all of this in the context of Hari Bhajan. So I will personally emphasize these four regulative principles at least on the same level as the other four regulative principles to begin with. And of course, as the practice grows, as the sadhaka advances, I will say that these four regulative principles from this verse of Shikshastakam will become actually much more important. These have to do with nishta, according to our acharyas. And according to Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, you will only attain prem if you chant Harinam in the spirit of this verse. So for Anishtita Bhakta, a progressive sadhaka who has his her eyes on the goal of prem, this third verse will become basically the all in all. And of course, I'm not saying he or she will forget the other four regulations that will break them, but they will come to the background, basically. And these four regulations have become more and more important. So I will say, in the beginning, yes, we are accepting this first, more rudimentary form of four regulative principles, but all of them in such a way we should embrace that they are promoting us into these other four regulative principles. So, although, again, my approach, my presentation here today is a little bit, I've tried at least to make it more broad and more comprehensive notion, and of course this is just like throwing some brainstorming, throwing some ideas that of course need to be further elaborated, probably ideally in each one's heart by the sincere practitioner. Again, this is broader, this is more comprehensive, and this demands more responsibility. But also, I'm not just sharing this presentation to make you feel overburdened by more responsibility. This becomes even more challenging and difficult. While at the same time, that's there. my hope, my idea is to present that in a way that is sustainable. Because also, as I mentioned, I've seen sometimes devotees getting neurotic or discouraged, to say the least, by not being able to follow some of the beginning four regulative principles. So I want to share this word so also they don't feel that they cannot be devotees because they cannot follow one of them or all of them in full. But again, if one sincerely is chanting Harinam, associating with sadhus, trying to get closer and closer to this third verse of Sri Shakshastakam, everything else that is missing will come eventually, accordingly. And again, there is still hope. There's lots of hope. So please, that's the intention of this presentation. I hope that may have added something to the conversation, the dialogue that we as Gaudiya community should maintain on an ongoing basis in order for our tradition to remain relevant to this world and to remain relevant for its own practitioners, and to upgrade and update its own relevance more and more till we reach the ultimate attainment where the dynamics and the upgrading will continue more and more. So it's not only 2.0, but who knows what. So, but at least something that I want to share from here. So do you have any questions or any thoughts you may like to share in the comment section, or we can continue exchanging with some different talks very soon. So thank you so much. Tomorrow in the morning, I'm continuing with the series of English Easter Ghost Year Q&A in the morning. So whoever may like, it will be tomorrow, Friday, at 8 a.m. Eastern Time. So if there are further thoughts on this or any other topic, we can continue speaking there. Srila Gurudev ki jai, Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Harinam Sankirtan ki jai, Gaur Bhaktavrinda ki jai, Gaur Pramanam. Arrivo.